Okay, so thanks a lot for the introduction, and I'm looking forward to sharing our results on quantum error correction by dissipation. So more specifically about the question, how can we really engineer dissipative processes in such a way that we can use them to coherently correct errors in a quantum system? But before I do this, I really want to thank the organizers for putting together this meeting. So both the scientific advisors and also the organizers in particular, Lincoln and Susanna and Sabrina and Vladan Vuletic. I think it's really a great opportunity to have a meeting which is so targeted on open quantum systems. So regarding the introduction, so I'm now at Waterloo at the IQC Institute for Quantum Computing. And because before I go into details, let me make a little advertisement because we still have a postdoc position available. So if you know somebody who's interested in it, so interested in joining a young but highly motivated team, so please have some contact me. So what we're doing is, we're a theory group, but we work very closely with experimentalists. The idea is that we really want to see new protocols where we can use a quantum system in such a way that we have a quantum advantage and in a way that it also works in practice, so in a lab. So two of our main research tracks are quantum networks and quantum simulations. So regarding the quantum simulations, this is something that I'm not going to talk about in this talk, but I would love to discuss this maybe later in the coffee break. And in particular, we are interested in quantum simulations which build a bridge. So this links up a bit to Tillmann's last slides. So we are interested in using quantum technology, quantum platforms, quantum hardware for quantum simulations of models from nuclear and in particular high energy physics. So really the question, how can we simulate lattice gauge theories from high energy physics? And so we've been very active in this region. So here are two of our most recent publications. And one, from my perspective, very interesting thing to consider will also be, can we use maybe dissipative protocols in order to make something like this happen? But for now, that's a total switch of gears. So let's talk about quantum error correction by dissipation. I'm going to leave out a lot of details, but many more details can be found in our publication there. And the executive summary is the quest of what we want to accomplish here is really keeping a qubit alive. And this is, for me, just the first step towards a much larger goal, which is to make quantum information processing more robust. So let's be a bit more specific. So it's not quantum error correction in general, but what I want to introduce here is our take on how to make quantum error correction autonomous, and it will become more clear in the slides to follow what I mean by really autonomous quantum error correction. And we have a very specific application in mind. Yeah, so I'm not going to talk about universal quantum computing, even though it would be nice. No? But for today, I really focus on a very specific application, which is really sensing. How can I use quantum error correction, in particular dissipative quantum error correction, in order to make precision measurements even better? And this is a perfect point in time to also point out other works. There's very interesting work by David Schuster, also Martin Plenio, who will talk later today, I believe, has some work on how to dissipatively stabilize sensors. And there's, of course, work by Preskill and Young, also on related issues. So to introduce and to motivate a bit quantum error correction is, of course, of key importance, I mean, for quantum computing, quantum communication, but also to quantum simulations. And today's topic for this talk is really all about exploring new strategies. And the strategy here, so you see here an pictorial representation, artist's view, to keep a qubit alive by coupling it to an engineered reservoir. So this is supposed to depict the engineered reservoir, and the idea is that the reservoir is really continuously stabilizing my encoded qubit. So this was very abstract. So to be much more concrete, in our case, the platform will be trapped ions. So quantum information will be encoded in the electronic states of a trapped ion, and the electronic degrees of freedom. The reservoir, so environment, in this case, the role of the environment will be played by the motional degrees of freedom to which the ions can couple to. And the specific example how to construct a dissipative code will be for the three-qubit code. So the three-qubit code will protect you or your qubit against spin flips. So as I said before, we're not aiming at universal quantum computing here. We're going to aim at sensing. In this case, we want to sense a signal in C direction. So you really do not want to correct C errors, because this way you would also correct your signal away. And as you will see later on, the ability to correct one type of errors can already help you to increase the sensitivity. So this is another pictorial view. So as I will outline now in more detail, there's a logical qubit encoded in three physical qubits, and there is a cooling in quotation marks mechanism which dissipatively cools out your error in case it occurs, and then leads you back with a good encoded qubit. So it has certain features. It uses only always-on couplings. Yeah, it's completely dissipative. Hence, it does run continuously in time, and it operates in a fully autonomous fashion, since, as you will see, there is a built-in feedback mechanism which accomplishes the following. So here, this is a logical subspace. So in this setting, the logical subspace is the dark manifold. So the dissipative mechanism, which I'm going to engineer, is not touching the dark manifold. And so you see here an encoded qubit, which lives in this manifold. And errors on the first, second, or third qubit, in this case, lead to orthogonal error spaces. And dissipation coherently drives really states from these orthogonal error spaces back into my dark manifold, which is untouched by my dissipative engineered mechanism. And as I said, the application is to improve high-precision sensing. And the reason why this works is simply because error correction, what it does for you, it really just enhances the effective coherence time of your qubit. And hence, with improved effective coherence times, you can reach improved sensitivities. So this is basically all you need to know. Everything else is just details. So I will go a bit more into the motivation. I will present to you the error correcting scheme. I will outline the application to sensing. And there will be some conclusion, of course, with open questions as per request. Motivation. Yeah. So for the motivation, let's go back to the textbook definition. How do you do a quantum error correcting code? Well, you encode your logical qubit in several physical qubits. You map your error syndrome to some ancillary qubits. You read it out, and then you perform a feedback operation. So if in our case, this is a logical 0, logical 1. Qubits look like this. And if you go to the Nielsen Chuang, then you can, your favorite textbook, then we can look at the gate-based implementation. And yeah. So it basically, in the first part of the circuit, it prepares the state and just checks the state. In the three-qubit code, so if the first qubit has been flipped, for instance, you can make something like a majority vote. So majority vote is all that happens here. So you know the first one is the only one of its kind, so it needs to be flipped back. And this is now to be contrasted by error correction by reservoir engineering. So what you do basically here, you have your quantum system where you live in the microscopic world, and then you take a large classical apparatus to probe your system, infer the error syndrome, map it into a classical number, and then out of the classical world you make a feedback operation back on your quantum system. So the conceptual approach here is quite different, because it's in a sense measurement free. And of course, you could argue the environment is measuring for you, but the experimentalist does not measure. Error correction takes place entirely at the microscopic level. So it's really one quantum system, so the environment quantum system correcting the other quantum system and stabilizing it. Yeah, and so how do I cool the errors out of my system? Well, it relies, as you will see, on sympathetic cooling of the motional modes, which removes errors. And yeah, this I would like to see as a first step, really towards self-correcting quantum systems in a way more broad sense. So the idea is really to find, in particular, also an experimentally feasible protocol which can be implemented in an actual experiment in a way that really surpasses previous experiments. Yeah? So this has been a huge success story, no? Because dissipative methods have a track record of being very robust. So we know that dissipative methods can be used for preparing known states. And yeah, so we even have Sebastian Diehl in the audience, who published one of the first papers on this, and also Susanna and Martin. They have a lot of pioneering work on this. And this really allows you to prepare dissipatively quantum states. And interestingly, this has very different features from unitary approaches, where you really use a unitary or gate-based approach to prepare your quantum state. And yeah, entanglement by dissipation has been shown in several systems. So here, atomic ensembles and trapped ions, superconducting architectures very recently. So we really know this works, and it works across platforms. And I want to take just 1 minute also to highlight one of my favorite aspects, which is related to my own work. So what I particularly like about it is that it can really allow you to extend the lifetime of entangled states. So here's a theory paper, and it was here a paper in a close collaboration with Eugene Polzig's group at the Niels Bohr Institute in Copenhagen. So this was already back in 2011. But basically what they showed there, they have always been successful in entangling atomic ensembles, right? In atomic ensembles, you have coherence times of milliseconds. And hence, if your coherence time is millisecond, so the entanglement lifetime also always was milliseconds, right? So, and using the dissipative approach put forward here and put into realization or put into practice here, it was really possible to extend the lifetime of these entangled states up to 1 hour. So it really does look like it's really much more robust. And this was really, also for me personally, the motivation, seeing that things are so successful in making things more long-lived in a state preparation setting. Can we also do something like this for unknown states? Yeah, because this is really a crucial difference. Because here, you really know your target states. It's one specific state which is known to you, but quantum error correction is a whole different setting. Now somebody hands you a state and it's unknown to you, which means you do not only stabilize one state, but you stabilize a whole manifold. And it's also conceptually quite different, because so what is done here, yeah, is in a sense very brutal, yeah, because you have an initial state and you completely destroy all coherences in your initial state, because your only goal is to provide a target state by building up new coherences. Yeah, it's very different for quantum error correction, because in quantum error correction, you handed an initial state and you're supposed to preserve the coherences. Yeah, so this is like really for the protocol design, like a whole new challenge. Yeah? So stabilize a whole manifold and please preserve coherences in a dissipative setting. Right, so here is the error correcting scheme. I'm going to cast everything in terms of mass equations. You could also write everything in Gauss operators if you like it better. But basically what I want, so I want a master equation which basically does this job for me. So this is just implementing a majority vote. So I have my three qubits and three things can go wrong. Yeah, so assuming single bit flip errors for now. The first could be flipped, the second or the third. And I'm making a majority vote by probing a stabilizer. So in this case, I'm probing the CC. So I'm probing the CC parity for 1-2 and 1-3, and you see those are violated. In this case, those are violated, or in this case, the 2-3 and the 3-1 are violated. So this, in a sense, is like the error signature, or it's the error syndrome. In a sense, it's different for all three cases. So in all three cases, I know which qubit needs flipping. Or in other words, I can, so this language is probably very familiar to some of you. So in terms of so-called conditional Lindblad operators, so it's a Lindblad operator which appears in my master equation. So ultimately what it does with a certain strength, it flips either the first, the second, or the third, but here there's a conditional part. Yeah. So for instance, let's look at the first one. Only if the C1, C3 stabilizer is violated, yeah, so then I get a non-zero contribution here and a non-zero contribution here, and only then the first one is flipped. An analogy for the second and the third. So I'm going to construct three conditional Lindblad operators, and then I have three master equations. So on a conceptual level, this is very easy and clean, but the challenge is then to convince your quantum optical system of interest to please realize a master equation like that. So how do I do that? Well, bless you. Here's a quantum error correcting scheme specifically for trapped ions. So here I encode my quantum information here in ground states, which are labeled 0 and 1. This is where my qubit sits. And I also have metastable states, F and E, here in this case. And since it's a system of trapped ions, I also have motional modes around. So here are the interactions that I need, which are really the prototypical interactions that you have in trapped ions. So I have a drive field, yeah, so which is shown here in red. Then here I have a coupling of my internal degrees of freedom to a motional mode called A here. And I have also some ancillary degrees of freedom. So which are labeled C1, C1, and C3. So motional modes A and B will be interrogation modes, which perform the majority vote, and motional modes C1, C2, C3 will be cooling modes, which will be used to cool out the system. So this is the error correcting scheme. Basically, this is to keep in mind the level scheme for a single ion. This is a level scheme for just one instance. In this case, the instance in which the first qubit has been flipped, but it works exactly the same way if you flip the second or the third one. And of course, you should think of a coherent superposition of the two possibilities. And like the trick here is really to make the error correction in such a way that the phonons that go out are indistinguishable, so you don't know which term of the superposition you are. So, basically you have this G from the previous slide, which is coupling here and which leads to a level splitting, which has to be large enough, such that in the case if one qubit has been flipped, you really get a resonant transition, which has on one arm the drive and on the other arm the qubit motional mode transition. And then here's the sympathetic cooling, which is just cooling the excitation out of the system, right? So here I have a spin excitation, it ends up as a motional mode excitation, which is then cooled out of the system efficiently in a coherent fashion. And so there are, of course, also unwanted processes. So for instance, there would be cases in which I have something like this. And of course, this would be an error correction which attempts to correct the error, but in fact introduces one. So something like this, for instance, and this just happens with a very reduced rate, because if I have two excitations, I have a level splitting which comes with a square root 2, so the detuning is larger, and my drive is such that it's in resonance with this detuning, but not in resonance here, which means that those processes, yes, they will happen, but they are suppressed. Yeah? And they're even more suppressed the larger your parameter G is there. Okay, so but how well does it work? Well, to give you a flavor how well it works, so you can look at this diagram. So here you have time and motion in dimensionless units, where gamma is the rate at which your single qubit bit flips happen. So on each of your physical qubits, and I see here is a fidelity. If I prepare a state, it would go down like this. For a single qubit, just one, because this is what we want to compare to, a single qubit, which is just subject to the noise. And these curves correspond to the case where instead of one, you're using three. So in principle, you have the noise mechanism acting on each of them, but at the same time, you're also applying your error correction. And you see it works the better, the larger this parameter G, the larger the coupling to the motional modes is. So it just leads to a more long-lived qubit. Well, and so we did an extensive analysis in terms of experimental imperfection, and in the interest of time, I'm going to cut this very, very short, but there is an appendix in the paper, and I think we have plenty of time for questions also afterwards. Let me just outline how it relates to sensing. Well, in a nutshell, as I said earlier, the precision of my sensor is proportional to 1 over square root of the coherence time. So what we're doing here is effectively making the coherence time longer, which enhances then the precision. And there's a lot of very interesting theory work, so I point you to these references, where people have really investigated in more detail how quantum error correction can help you to make sensing more precise. Here is just the prototypical example. Application of quantum error correction to metrology. So I initialize my state here. I make a Ramsey pulse. So I start here. It's like a logical qubit, just with equally weighted superposition. And then I have it evolve under my signal. My signal is here in C direction. Could be a magnetic field in C direction, the accumulator phase here. Then I make a Ramsey pulse again, and I make a detection. And you can see this looks very nice in theory, but there can be bit flips. So if I have, for instance, a transverse magnetic field, which is fluctuating, and so can immediately see if I have errors like this, what will they do to me? They will lead to the phase being scrambled. So the phase, instead of nicely accumulating, it would go back and forth and would make something like a random walk. So this is why these errors would degrade my sensitivity. So here's just what I said. The first Ramsey pulse, I make the superposition, I have the free evolution. In this case, it's perfect. I make the second Ramsey pulse, and then I see that the phi, the phase that I wanted to measure, appears here in the cosine. So if I just measure the population, like how often I find the qubit in zero, then I get this cosine square, and by evaluating it, I can infer the phi, because I know the times that I have waited. So this is how I get my phase out of this. And this is just here the precision. The precision in the ideal case goes like 1 over n times the Ramsey time times the capital T. T is the total time, and the total time is just the number of runs, like how often I do this experimentally, times the Ramsey time. So this is my precision. So you see, in principle, my precision would go just better and better the longer I wait. No? The longer I make my Ramsey time, the more patient I am, the more phase I accumulate, the better the precision gets. But this is not the case in the presence of noise. So this is really to illustrate this. So if you look at this blue curve, it's really showing you the signal, right, which I'm measuring, my measurement probability, with no errors. Okay, but if I introduce now the errors, so like the bit flips, you see no, with the errors, but no correction, you get the red line, which really drastically reduces your visibility, so you will be hard-pressed to get a precise estimate for your phase from that, but if you apply error correction, then you get the visibility back. And these are actually, this is a plot which is exactly for the numbers that I showed earlier. Yeah, so this is a realistic estimate. And this is just a bit more precise statement. So here I'm plotting the precision normalized, so like really times the total runtime, and it's here plotted versus the waiting time in the Ramsey experiment. So, and here's what we saw earlier, so this blue dotted line. If there are no errors whatsoever, then I just, it's easy, no? I make my Ramsey time longer and longer, so more phases accumulated, I get more and more precise. And this is, of course, not the real life. So if I have now errors and no correction, so for the gamma chosen here, so you see, you start out, you get a bit better, but only up to some degree. No, because after a certain waiting time, errors and flips, they will just catch up with you, they bite you, and then the sensitivity gets worse. And what error correction does for you, it doesn't completely resolve the problem, so the shape stays really the same. So this is the curve with errors and correction. You have basically the same phenomenon, only the curve is really shifted, like this turning point at which the errors like overwhelm your signal, it just happens later, right? And since it happens later, you're able to go deeper down, basically, and reach a higher precision. And this is, again, for realistic experimental parameters and for the specific scheme that I introduced. Yeah, and this already brings me to my conclusion. So what I showed you is a dissipative quantum error correcting scheme, and it's specifically made for trapped ions. So it's for one specific system, and like we custom tailored everything, in fact, for the Innsbruck system by Rainer Blatt. So this is all the numbers that you saw were for this type of experiment. And as you have seen, in this case, the experimentalist does not go and perform measurements, but it's really autonomous in the sense that there's a built-in feedback mechanism that in case there has been an error, there's a resonance condition, like the dissipative mechanism shifts itself into resonance as soon as there is an error. And this leads to a coupling which allows you to cool out the error. Right. And instead, this is a bit different from the gate-based approach. And in our case, we applied this to sensing. And yeah, we showed like how applying the scheme can allow you to measure, yeah, magnetic fields, for instance, with greater sensitivity. And this is one step towards a greater vision. So the greater vision in this case is the goal to perform quantum information processing in a self-stabilized manner. Yeah, using quantum systems to stabilize other quantum systems to make information processing really more robust and more stable through dissipative stabilization mechanisms, and to do this really for increasingly complex tasks. Yeah, so this was so we're hoping for proof of concept demonstration in the lab. And yeah, basically the aim of the game is really to manipulate non-orthogonal quantum states while preserving their coherence. So what we have seen experimentally so far was really very nice quantum state preparation, where you get a very stable known state, but you destroy all initial coherences in the process. And if you want to work towards this vision of really making quantum information processing more robust, you really need to demonstrate also experimentally that one can really handle unknown states, that one can really handle coherences dissipatively. And this brings me to my open question slide. So some open questions, of course there are many more, but from my perspective, can we find practical dissipative implementations, like not only on paper but only in the lab, but also in the lab, for instance for transversal codes, for topological quantum error correction, and also can we correct loss errors? So what you have seen here, it's a very specific type of errors, it's Pauli errors, no? But what happens if you lose your quantum system altogether? Now, if you just have a loss error, which is of course extremely, extremely irrelevant for quantum networks. Or how can we use dissipative processes to engineer exotic quantum channels? So what do I mean by an exotic quantum channel? Well, you might want to use it for dissipative preparation of complex quantum many-body states, which we also discussed here at this workshop, or to make dissipative algorithms. So there's a new paper on the archive by Susanna and Martin, and maybe one could even go beyond and make dissipative quantum information processing work for special cases, or dissipative annealing, for instance, for classical optimization problems, or yeah, so there are like lots of exotic dissipative channels that would be interesting to construct, to harness, but also to describe. And I'm wondering whether one could also use variational algorithms or even machine learning to help us constructing such cases in the quantum many-body regime. Or also to use dissipative methods for robust and hopefully experimentally feasible quantum simulators of lattice gauge series, something that is very close to my heart. Or also for entanglement distillation, which is of course extremely related to error correction. Yeah, there are tons of more questions, and I'm looking forward to your questions.
Yeah, thank you very much for the talk, and this is open for questions.
First of all, thank you for a very nice talk. And I have a question, which is the following. So what is the connection between your protocol based on writing Lindblad operators such that you preserve a manifold and other protocol based on the coherence-free subspace, if there exists a connection between
The coherence-free subspace is extremely important. And also for quantum simulations and trapped ions, like the references that I showed earlier, none of the two works would have worked without working in a decoherence-free subspace. Yeah, I would say the fundamental difference is if I work in a decoherence-free subspace, so for instance in trapped ions, then errors are like there is a mechanism like magnetic fields in z direction which lead to random phases. If I manage to work on a decoherence-free subspace, something that could lead to an error in principle, if I do the proper encoding, does not lead to an error. So for instance, I could think of a scenario where just I arrange things such that these phases lead to global phases, right, which then are not physical. So in a sense, you're using more qubits, but then you don't get an error at all. And so this is different here because, as you have seen on one of the previous slides, I really do take my state out of my logical subspace, and then I need to get it back. So it like really goes out and it goes back again. And the decoherence-free subspace, I arrange things such that the error itself doesn't even lead to a logical error. At least the way how we implemented it.
Actually, if I may comment on this, story of stabilizing states and even subspaces by dissipation has, of course, a much longer history. Actually, in like
even
20
longer.
Years ago, yes, we and actually Martin Pliny was also involved with it, and Peter Knight and so on wrote papers using just this mechanism. Actually, you have a decoherence-free subspace, but then you couple the system very strongly to the environment, and then this subspace actually gets stabilized. So the two things are actually related, at least in this context.
About this using dissipation to correct the error, what I'm wondering is, have you considered this sort of temperature effect of the environment? But besides that, it seems that you like done something to the environment. Presumably, that will sort of heat up the environment eventually.
So the question was, did we consider the finite temperature of the environment? Yeah. And this is an important thing to consider here. In this case, the environment as emotional modes. Mm-hmm. So these emotional modes, they're permanently cooled. However, you don't have, like you have phonons, like the number of phonons in your bath is not exactly zero. And of course, this gets better and better the better your cooling mechanism is. And there's, so maybe I just refer you to us discussing a bit more later, or also our appendix. So we made an estimate on how the number of quanta that are in your environment affects your error correcting code. So, I mean, there is an effect, but according to our estimate, none that would spoil the game. But it's of course important.
Christine, can you estimate in the case of having defacing in a typical Ramsey setup, so we remain then standard quantum limited, but can you estimate what sort of improvement you get in the numerator? Is possible to give anything?
You mean in terms of scaling?
Slightly analytical, yeah.
Yes. So, okay, there are two parts maybe to the question. The first one would be in terms of scaling, in terms of the number of logical qubits. Is this what you meant, or?
No, well, the scaling, let's say in the moment that you have a component of the noise in the span of the Hamiltonian, then we know that the scaling, the asymptotic one will not change, right?
Yeah, right.
But this doesn't mean that you can get practically relevant improvements just by enhancing the numerator part of the precision, which I guess is what you showed in your curve.
Right.
What I wonder is what the strength of that change that you can introduce.
So for a single part, for a single logical qubit, unfortunately, I do not have an analytical expression, even though it would be very interesting to have one. So if I have several logical qubits, which I didn't address here, then of course we know, so there has been this beautiful paper by Susanna and Ignacio, that in C direction, if I have C signal and C noise, I do not get any improvement, right? But there's another result if I have orthogonal noise. So I don't have the 1 over n, but I also do not get back to the classical limit. So there is something which is in between.
No, but I was meaning just because, let's say, these results are interesting, let's say, from the very theoretical point of view, but maybe experimentally less interesting, let's say, in the sense that you would also like to know what sort of resolution you will achieve, right?
The resolution.
We're working with small n, So then I wanted to know whether it would be possible, whether you've already estimated, let's say, even if I remain with a scaling 1 over square root of the number of probes, right? But what do I have in the numerator? How much better would I do, should I implement error correction in the small n domain?
Yeah, so I do not have an analytical result, but we do have some numerical results for this. Yeah, so we have some numerical results for a single qubit, a single logical qubits, which are the one that I showed there. Yeah, so it really... Yeah, so we have results for a single qubit, logical qubit, and we have results for several logical qubits. And the results for several logical qubits I completely cut out here because of lack of time. So I was restricting here everything just for a single logical qubit. And for a single logical qubit, this is actually for really the true experimental parameters. So this is really the improvement in sensitivity that you get. Unfortunately, only numerical. So it's really a complicated problem with all the types of noise processes that can happen. So we do not have any analytical result on this. And we do have some semi-analytical results for how it scales with the number of logical qubits, that in principle, you can regain the scaling with the number of logical qubits, but only until some limit. I mean, not. I think you would be more interested in if you scale it up more and more and more. But so until some limit, you regain the proper scaling, what you can achieve beyond classical, but below what you could get in the noiseless case.
Okay, are there further questions?
So I'm a bit... maybe I missed the explanation. So how come in this graph, the ideal error correction and the sort of the real error correction are basically the same?
Yeah, basically, maybe I should explain what I mean by ideal error correction and real error correction. So in this case, by ideal error correction, I mean that the scheme really implements the master equation that we want to have. So ideal error correction means an ideal dissipative version of the three-qubit code. However, it's maybe a misnomer in the sense that it's not the ideal correction of error, because the three-qubit code per se, even if it's the ideal three-qubit code, is not correcting all the errors, because by construction the three-qubit code can only correct single-qubit errors. So as soon as I have two bit flips, then the error correction will fail. So by correcting the error, you will introduce a logical error. So what I mean here, ideal error correction really means only ideal three-qubit code, but it doesn't mean that we get rid of all the errors. And this is the reason why it's only shifting it down, but it's not getting straight, because it's not an ideal error correction. So this is just showing that our scheme is doing what we wanted to do. Right, because this is I didn't make this so clear probably, but we want a master equation which makes a majority vote. However, there are undesired processes which just are due to the quantum optical implementation of it, and a priori it would not have been clear that our dissipative processes really correctly reproduces a three-qubit code, but there are tricks that you can make by like making very large couplings that really allow you to make a quantum optical implementation which make your dissipation behave like the three-qubit code. And this is why they are almost on top of each other, and it's like demonstrating that the engineered dissipation does a job, but it's very far away from the ideal case because the three-qubit code can only do so much for you.
So you have these higher dimensional dark subspaces now, but you're assuming that the initial state is pure and gives some state in the subspace. I mean, would it be easy to modify your scheme to just, I mean, also initial to do the initialization of the system by
selecting? You can in principle use the scheme for the initialization if you want. Yeah.
And how difficult is that to modify your operator? Would you know how to modify your operator so that this is...
I'm not sure whether I understand the question. I mean, I would have to make... I think
to select out of this manifold of, say, now in your case, two states, yeah, if you could select a direction by the dissipation and whether this is...
The direction? So
in
not
this subspace. So whether you can... I mean, you have a... two-dimensional subspace now?
Yes.
That is dark. I mean, can you also, and you're assuming that the initial state is pure, so it's one.
Yeah, even so, I wouldn't, like in the setting of quantum error correction, right, I'm assuming the initial state is pure. But if your goal is something else, like your goal is maybe to make a state, or like to prepare an encoded qubit, then you could also... You could start from a mixed state in principle. However, I strongly recommend you make, like if you make want a state of this form, I strongly recommend you really, and you kind of know what type of qubit you want, like you should start from a state which has only one qubit flipped, no? Because otherwise your correction will do exactly a logical bit flip, no?
Okay, then maybe it's time to conclude at this point. So thank you very much for you both speakers and all the audience. And now we will have half an hour coffee break, and we will reconvene at 10 to 11 for the breakout sessions. Thank you.